I'd like to give you the website office report for February 22nd. We continue to break records. We had the greatest week of all time this last week. We had 962 per day. 500 megabytes equal to 10,000 typed pages or 100 television programs or 50 sermons were downloaded and looked at by people that checked into it. And I'll just give you some of the days here. For example, on last Sabbath, we had the best Sabbath of all time, 969, almost 1,000 people looked into the site on that Sabbath day. And then Sunday was the second best in 64 weeks. We had, the best Wednesday of all time. We had 1,256 people who checked into the website last Wednesday. So that is really a wonderful tool. And for example, in the short month of February alone, we will have had more than 100 people who asked about the nearest local church to their home. And so we send these references out to the various area coordinators when those come in, 6 here and 12 there and 5 the other place, and they call them on the phone or go visit them and check it out and try to find out what the level of interest is. Also, they announce here that I'm to be visiting Seattle, God willing, during the last holy day of Unleavened Bread on the 14th of April. And also, of course, Pentecost, we're to be over in Guntersville State Park, south of Huntsville, Alabama. And it's a very beautiful place that we've actually used for a feast site in past years. So we will look forward very much to that. And as I said, my calendar is rapidly filling up. I'm supposed to do campaigns everywhere from down in New Orleans up to Minneapolis and Grand Rapids, Minnesota, out to Las Vegas. Terrible. Somebody's got to do it. No, I promise you, we will probably stay in an outlying motel. I cannot stand that so-called strip with its huge crowds in Las Vegas. But surprisingly, we have quite a mailing list there, and we now have a hosted fellowship group that is meeting every Sabbath. And they had gone down, the gentleman and Mr. Phil Dunnigan, who was the area coordinator for that area, have been in contact recently, and he just sent me an email this morning. And so I penciled it in, I think, sometime in May, about the second week or so, on my calendar to be able to go over there. Now, to read you a little bit of the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Wednesday, February 21st. Sect disavows tenets. Some people don't understand what that means. Sect, that's their way of putting down a church organization and calling it the last half of insect. So it sounds very bad, sect. It's sort of like something you get on your hand. Sect disavows tenets. That means a cult eschews its former doctrines, and woe to him who printeth them anyway. Crying copyright violation, it demands money donated to a breakaway church. Portents of the Last Days, another subtitle by Jess Braven, a gentleman who called Mark and then called me and with whom we spoke at some length a few weeks ago. Pasadena, California, on January 7th, 1934, that is, he filed this from Pasadena, California. He's not saying that that took place in Pasadena. On January 7, 1934, the Radio Church of God took to the air with the remarkable teachings of its founder, a formal advertising man named Herbert W. Armstrong. Among them, that the British and their colonists in America had descended from the lost tribes of Israel, that God was not a trinity but a family, parenthesis, father and son, but no Holy Ghost. Technically, you can see what he is saying, but anyone who reads that is going to really believe something which is a lie. My father never said there was no Holy Spirit. He merely showed from the Bible and absolutely proved that the Holy Spirit is not a third person, a triumvirate, a trinity, but that the Holy Spirit is the power, the nature, the mind, the life of God, which he can impart to human beings by begettal and eventual rebirth with the power of God's Holy Spirit. He goes on, and that the apocalypse would begin in 1936, point blank lie, he never said that. Later postponed in 1943, point blank lie, he never said that, never said there would be anything significant about 1943. Then 1972, well, he must have got that from the old concept of 19-year time cycles, but my father didn't say the apocalypse would occur then because he never used that kind of language. He knew the word apocalypse merely means revelation, What the man meant is the Great Tribulation, but he didn't say so. And then indefinitely, so there are a lot of half-truths in that statement. On his program, The World Tomorrow, and in his magazine, A Plain Truth, Mr. Armstrong called his beliefs the product of methodical explanation of the Bible, which he said was, quote, a coded message not allowed to be revealed and decoded until this time, end quote. I'm not familiar with that quotation. I never heard my father say that in my life. I did hear a couple, 3 years ago, someone that wrote a book and said that the Bible was written in some kind of a code in the English language, which I know is nonsense because the Bible was not even written in English, and English didn't even exist when it was written, but nevertheless, my father never said that. Members contributed up to 30% of their income. That is a lie. Some few might have. But of course, first tithe is required according to God. The second tithe is theirs to keep. They didn't contribute that. And third tithe was once every 3 years or prorated to about 2.8% every year over the course of, say, a decade or so, and was for the poor. But nevertheless, they still continue to publish that lie. And it sounds like the church required everyone to give 30% of their income. Not true. Some attended the church's Ambassador College and joined a media empire that strove to link current events to prophecies of a coming tribulation. Strove to link. He means, of course, and failed by that language, obviously. Renamed the Worldwide Church of God, the congregation claimed 100,000 members, not true, it was well over 150, and $131 million annual budget, not true, it was well over $220 million by the time I was out of it. When the founder, who called himself Christ's Chosen Apostle, died in 1986 at age 93, then his successor had a message of his own for the faithful. Mr. Armstrong was dead wrong. Nice play on words there. Joseph Tocat Sr., whom Mr. Armstrong had anointed just a week before his death, began abandoning the church's unusual doctrines one by one. In 1989, he suspended publication of the founder's final summation, quote, Mystery of the Ages, end quote, a 351-page work that Mr. Armstrong had called perhaps the most important book written in 1900 years. I'm impressed because I wrote major sections of it, which was never admitted by anyone. Half of the church's members left, tithes dwindled, the church was forced to slash its payroll drastically and liquidate a real estate empire that included campuses in Texas and England. Last year, it sold its 48-acre Pasadena headquarters complex, including one of California's leading concert halls, to condo developers. Through it all, a splinter group in Oklahoma continued to take Mr. Armstrong at his word. Wanting to provide new converts with all of Mr. Armstrong's insights, the group began to print Mystery of the Ages and give it away. The Worldwide Church sued for copyright infringement. The Oklahoma group said it was only exercising its freedom of religion. The result is an unusual legal challenge in which the courts are asked to debate between two rights protected under the Constitution, with each side claiming not only the law, but also God on its side, and a novel copyright twist for good measure. Worldwide Church hasn't lost sales of its founder's book because it never charged for it while publishing it, and certainly has no wish to sell it now. Nor has its adversary ever sold the book. But Worldwide claims it is entitled to all the tithes and other contributions given to the splinter group's church by people inspired by copies of the book that the group printed. New twist, I didn't know that. That might make Mr. Fleury a little anxious if Worldwide is going after all of his money. Not only a fine for copyright violation, but going after his money. Late last month, the divided federal appellate court, reversing a lower federal court, found in favor of the Worldwide Church. A hearing on the damage claim is on hold while the U.S. Supreme Court decides whether to hear the Oklahoma Church's appeal. The case is already having an impact beyond the pews. Last week, a federal appeals court cited it in the decision it would shut down Napster website's free music sharing service. The judges relied on the Mystery of the Ages decision for their finding that Napster could infringe copyrights even if it didn't make any money by its actions. Closely watching the religious battle are dozens of other splinter groups, or churches rather, and unaffiliated Armstrong believers, some of whom have posted Mystery of the Ages and other Armstrong works on the internet. Following the fight, too, is Garner Ted Armstrong. Not true. Following the fight, I didn't even know much about it, not following it. The only thing I know is what somebody emailed me one day. I have nothing else to do with it, don't know about it, don't want to know, don't care. I'm not following it. But he says I'm following it. All right, so let him have his way. Woe unto you, scribes. Anyway. Following the fight, too, is Garner Ted Armstrong, once the church's radio voice and heir apparent, who now leads his own church in Texas. I didn't know that. I hadn't the faintest idea this was my church. I thought it was God's church and that Jesus Christ is the head of it and that I'm merely a servant who could drop dead of a heart attack right in the middle of a sermon or when I stumble down the stairs on the way out. And I've told people time and again that that is so, that it is God's church, not mine. But they say it's my own church, preaching many doctrines of a father who publicly disfellowshipped him 23 years ago. Says Garner Ted, whenever there's an earthquake in Pasadena these days, that's my father rolling over in his grave. Interesting article. Front page, left-hand column, continues on to page 6, right in the Wall Street Journal. Well, at least they spelled my name right. If they got almost nothing else right, they spelled my name right. Striving to tie in or to link current events to prophecies. How many times have I told you that you could wake up one morning and there would be a massive war going on in Israel? How many times have I talked about Saddam Hussein's insane move toward possessing chemical, biological, and even nuclear weapons? Now, just the other day, you all knew that allegedly American aircraft, together with some British aircraft, numbering up to 36 in all, had a very well-planned, well-executed attack on a lot of the command and control centers and the SAM sites with their Firecan radar, and that they had allegedly taken them out, that these super sophisticated stealth type weapons, such as standoff weapons like smart bombs that can be fired from 50, 60 or whatever miles away, along with cruise missiles had been used, that many of them were F-18 Hornets off U.S. aircraft carriers in both the oceans nearby, Eastern Mediterranean, in the Gulf, and that also the British Tornadoes and F-18s along with F-16s and the other aircraft with the various radar guidance systems like the EWACs had taken part. Then you saw our government defending it, and you saw France, Germany, China, and Russia heavily criticizing it, even some of our NATO allies, and even though we flew off Turkish bases, the Turks didn't like it very much either. But it was billed before all of us as a strike which was merely, in a sense, routine, that many other strikes had occurred earlier. But because there was growing sophistication and allegedly growing cooperation, like a network electronically between central command and control areas and the various missile launching sites all over the areas around Mosul or near Baghdad itself and on the southern no-fly zone. You've heard it all, you've read it all, you know all about it, so it's already old news today. But that isn't what really happened. What really happened was that American spy satellites had detected not only there were 6 armored divisions of Saddam Hussein's army that had been moved right to the Syrian border, and that Assad's son had already said that they could have free access through the Baqa Valley to northern Israel. We told you that before, and I've written about it before. But suddenly they detected a movement of huge, big missiles on their various mobile launching platforms. And so they let the Israelis and the Americans know about it. And we were to launch a preemptive strike, not against those radar sites at all, and not against those command and control sites north of Baghdad or Mosul or down along the southern no-fly zone at all, but against those 6 armored divisions that were on the Syrian border, and also against those mobile missile sites which were about to launch missiles against Israel. It was within hours of a countdown. Here is the Debka file. It is a very well-organized Israeli intelligence organization. It has its own website. And I was given a heads up by one of our hosts up in the Ohio area just this morning on it. Thursday, just the other day, the day the Middle East stepped back from the brink, February 23rd. Very few people know how close the Middle East came on Thursday, February 22nd, to exploding in a regional war. At 6 a.m., Israel placed its forces on high missile readiness after being alerted by U.S. intelligence to movements by 6 Iraqi armored divisions deployed close to the frontier with Syria. American satellites additionally picked up Iraqi preparations for launching long-range surface missiles. Debco's spial sources disclosed the trigger of this sequence, a warning from a European government, probably Britain, to Iraqi intelligence that Israel would not again sit still and wait for Iraqi missiles to rain down on its towns as it did in the 1991 Gulf War. It planned to preempt any missile attack by knocking out Iraqi missile concentrations on the ground, as well as the six armored divisions posted for advance since early in the Palestinian Intifada. How would they do that? This Iraqi strength, Saddam was told, would be disposed of swiftly with the help of neutron bombs. The Israelis let them know, we're going to use nuclear bombs. Now, neutron bombs are not effective by a huge explosion which levels standing structures. Instead, they explode, probably in the air, and they give out deadly rays, neutron rays. And they kill everything that is living, but they leave trees, grass, and buildings alone. They just kill animal flesh. And the Israelis were going to do it. Iraqi decision makers were impressed enough to test American and Israeli reflexes. And that's what they were really doing when they began tracking these aircraft much more closely, locking on. And then, of course, we have signals. It's almost like an old transponder idea that I used to fly with, where you can actually identify the radar that is hitting you, tell exactly where it's coming from, and then you can identify by an alert or a warning light in your cockpit whether or not it's called fire can radar, whether or not the radar has gone from a passive to an active about to fire mode, so that our F-18s or F-16s or whatever can evade these huge big SAMs that are about as long as a telephone pole come roaring up there to try to destroy them. So they, the Iraqis, pushed ahead with technical preparations for the launching of surface missiles, taking them up to one stage before Saddam would give the firing order. Israel received the information that the missiles would be ready for that last button to be pushed at 6 p.m. Thursday evening. 1 hour earlier, U.S. AWACS and four Hawkeye A-2C spy planes and other 36 assorted U.S. and British fighter craft took off from the Turkish base at Incirlik and from U.S. Navy carriers in the region and headed for Iraq's western desert. Their mission was to flatten Saddam's surface missiles the moment the spy planes reported them operational. Instead, they went to Plan B. Opposite Syria's Mediterranean coast, Israeli Air Force aircraft took off at the same time. As they crossed over the desert, the U.S. and British airborne flotilla ran into fierce anti-aircraft and anti-air missile fire from batteries in place north of the Iraqi oil city of Mosul. Altogether, 35 missiles were fired, and so they fired back. So it was not, as we were told at all, a very, very long-term, planned-for, carefully orchestrated strike to take out some command and control centers and some missile batteries at all. It was Plan B. They'd actually been sent because they thought they were going to have to take out those six armored divisions next to the border with Syria. The Allied fighters blasted the Iraqi batteries but caused very little damage, and that's true. As they say, the BDA, or battle damage assessment, proved to be far less than desired, and some of the missiles landed in open fields, and some of them, in fact, did kill some civilians, including young boys. A few minutes after 6 p.m., everyone started breathing upon learning that the Iraqi surface missiles had become stationary. Israel called off its missile alert at 19:30, or 7:30 hours, as Debka File reported, a half an hour later. Thursday's scare can be expected to recur in the coming days and weeks. President Bush hinted as much when he warned Saddam at his Washington news conference Thursday, February 22nd, which I saw, and I think most of you did, that if he developed weapons of mass destruction, there would be consequences. But the U.S. president knows very well that the Iraqi dictator is already engaged in developing those weapons, including a nuclear bomb. January 22nd, 2 days before he took his seat in the Oval Office, the New York Times, under the heading Iraq Rebuilt Weapons Factories, officials say, quote, filled several columns of the rundown on the production at an industrial complex in Fallujah, west of Baghdad, together with information containing reports laid before the new president. What did I tell you just before he took office? I said, President Bush is going to be aged several years in a matter of hours. when he gets called in and sat down, and the CIA and the NSC and the FBI briefers, along with the Pentagon Joint Chiefs of Staff, are there, and they give him all the nation's secrets, and they tell him what is the full, real state of affairs in the Middle East, in Europe, in Korea, and all around the world, he is going to have a huge load descend upon his shoulders like you cannot begin to imagine. Now, where is Colin Powell right now today? He just got to Jerusalem a matter of about 2 hours ago. Where was he before that? Egypt. Does the Bible anywhere say they call to Egypt? They go to Assyria or to the Germans? Does it say that anywhere? Are we a little sect, a little cult, striving so hard to try to interpret things happening in the world in the light of what the Bible says? Why, it's easy to understand that events that are taking place in the world are fulfilling biblical prophecy if you know anything at all about biblical prophecy, which I know most of our brethren do. Now, the paper that officials were quoting provided details on a reconstruction of three factories, all of which were previously involved in producing chemical or biological agents and were closely monitored by UN inspectors before Butler and Unscombe were kicked out of there over 2.5-3 years ago. Bush, therefore, has all the information he needs to justify U.S. military action against Iraq, and his use of the word consequences indicates his intention of doing so. I think Saddam Hussein wanted to try out the younger Bush within just weeks of him assuming the presidency. And I think he was ready to launch a war and wanted to just see how prepared were we, what would be our response. I think the wild card that he didn't count upon are Israeli neutron bombs. I think that scared that mad dictator just enough that he backed off. But he was ready to give the command that would have sent Scuds, missiles, carrying this time, no doubt, chemical or biological warheads, raining down upon Tel Aviv and Haifa and other Israeli cities, just 3 days ago, while we slept. That's the reality. And a lot of times you don't know. Now, you won't know either, because none of this is going to be on CNN. None of this is going to be on ABC, NBC. It will not be in the major news media. This is a source which is a private investigatory outfit in Jerusalem, in Israel, and they have agents and people who report to them all over the world. It's quite an impressive thing. They said early Thursday morning, U.S. satellites picked up Iraqi ground-to-ground missiles moving west with launching equipment. U.S. intelligence estimates that the missiles would be ready for launch by the evening prompted Israel to place all of its security forces on ready Thursday morning. According to fresh reports from certain Arab capitals, Syrian President Bashar Assad has reached a strategic decision. This is interpreted in two ways. He either agreed to grant the six Iraqi armored divisions deployed on the Iraqi-Syrian frontier passage through his country, or has given the Hezbollah the nod to unleash a long-range rocket attack against northern Israel, or both. This development is behind the grave warning the U.S. and Israeli governments issued to the Syrian government on Thursday morning. The night before, northern Israeli towns and villages issued warnings to all of their citizens to prepare for long-range rocket attacks from Lebanon. I won't go on to read it all, but there is quite another scenario that is interesting here. They go into great detail to prove that two of the top-level representatives of Yasser Arafat went to Baghdad less than a week ago and actually arranged for Yasser Arafat and all of his top people to immediately be airlifted to Baghdad in the case a war broke out. Arafat has not been able to pay his troops for the last 2 months. He is in some trouble with his own constituency, and fully expected that there would be quite an uprising. And they are saying now, and there's much more in here, by the way, about the Israelis and what they're responding to it. They have, for example, begun to carve up corridors all over Israel, in the West Bank, in Gaza. They have now been bulldozing, as they did recently, just a couple, 3 days ago, a major police station at an intersection in a strategic area of the West Bank, just chased the Palestinians out of there and just bulldozed it down. So under Sharon, as I told you, a far more hard line is being taken, and they are getting prepared for defensive lines that they could possibly fall back upon if they had to, because they know that pockets of Palestinians are all through the West Bank and Gaza, and that they are finding arms, that the arms are being clandestinely shipped to them. And so there is very great potential for real trouble over there right now. That does not take to me any striving whatsoever. I don't have to strive when I look at Matthew 24, verses 6 through 14. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. I don't know if you have noticed an increase in earthquake activity, but I have. I've looked at many of the reports on the internet, and they are coming with more frequency. And those that have been experienced in the last very few months have been up in the 6 and 7 category, much more powerful than most we've experienced in recent years. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. When these things begin to happen. Why? Why would anyone hate a church organization? Why would anyone hate a disciple of Jesus Christ? There are church organizations called the Disciples of Christ. Why would anyone hate a Methodist? I don't know. I haven't the faintest idea. Why would anyone hate a Baptist? Except maybe Catholics do. I don't know. But I still don't know. I don't have the faintest idea. Why would anyone hate a church that is doing nothing more than just going to church? And then they go to work. Then they go to church. Then they go to work, and all week they're out there, and they're working at their jobs, they're living their lives, and then Sunday comes along, and they go to church. Why would all nations, not just the weird, rabid, I have other names for them, but I desist, Islamic fundamentalists who say that all of us in the United States are, quote, the great Satan, end quote, and make no difference between Methodists, Baptists, Lutherans, Episcopalians, or any of the others, but would like to kill us just because we are Americans and we are non-Islamic. But why would the disciples of Christ himself, in the latter days, at the time of the end, be hated of all nations? Are we hated because we are doing a little bitty, almost most unnoted work? Are we hated because we've got a television program on at 5 a.m. Central Time over WGN, and it is really upsetting a lot of people? Well, you know, I see a little bit of hatred, a little bit of contempt when I read articles like that one I did in the Wall Street Journal. And I know that there are an awful lot of people that have a lot of hatred toward the entire work, as we always called it, that was done by my father and all the pioneers from Ambassador College and myself over a period of more than 40-some years. And I know that that latent hatred and anger is still in the hearts of an awful lot of people, but primarily those are people here in the United States that belong to different religious organizations who hate everything that my father stood for and everything that he preached. But very few of the people that my dad talked to overseas had any cause to hate him. You don't get people to hate you when you go and you provide them a wonderful banquet in a beautiful glittering hall with chandeliers, and you give them the choicest foods that their nation can provide, whether you're talking about Abidjan or whether you're talking about Beijing, West Africa or China. Doesn't matter. And if you go there and you speak before a civic club, and you talk about the principle of give versus get, and you appear as an American philanthropist, and you come in a G3 or a G2 with a red carpet and a big black limousine and a lot of bags of money to give away, and you're preceded by a Japanese envoy who has gotten you in because of his association with the Japanese Diet, which is their parliament, and all of their various embassies around the world, so that the Japanese embassy arranges with that nation, whether it is Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya or whether it was Haile Selassie down in Addis Ababa, doesn't matter. And my father would go there and would have a banquet. And the strongest witness and warning that he ever gave was the final culmination of a patented speech that he gave, every single one of them, almost identical speech. Asked the people on the video pod who were there. They would say, where is he? He'd say, he's not reading, he's up there talking. He is talking, he's ad-libbing ostensibly. But he had it so programmed and so memorized that Dick Quincer was telling me several years ago that he and Ronnie Procy would be back there and they would be looking and they would say, he's on page 6, line 14, because they knew exactly where my dad was going with that speech because he said it so many times. And at the very end of it, the great witness and warning was a quote from the 1950s David Lawrence column in United States News and World Report that the problems of this world are going to be solved by, quote, a strong hand from someplace, end quote. Great applause, and he sat down and people congratulated him. It was a great speech. My dad was a very good speaker, and it was a speech about peace, about nations ought to live in harmony. Everything that he said was wonderful. Everything that he said was good. Everything he said was great. But he didn't go there as an evangelist, and he didn't go there as an apostle, and he didn't go there as the leader of a church. He went there under the aegis of a college and as a philanthropist and was giving money to everybody from King Boomabal to Marcos. I guess Imelda bought another couple hundred pairs of shoes with that money. And telling them that there was going to be world peace and he wanted to be given the Nobel Prize. And Mr. Rader was actually trying to get it for him to be an ambassador for world peace. I'm just saying that if I look at what Christ said, if I go back to the Bible and I say, did he mean what he said? Is this time element something that escapes me? Would it escape the writer of the article of the Wall Street Journal? Would they think that Matthew 24 means now and ahead of this time we live in today? Or would they, it doesn't matter what they think, of course, because I know what it means, but they would assign it, of course, to the time before the armies of Titus came down to destroy Jerusalem in 70-71 AD. And they would think, oh, that was all fulfilled long ago. We know better. He was talking about the time of the end. The disciples had asked him, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Didn't say what will be the sign of the next go-round of terrible trouble for the Jews here in Jerusalem. And remember, when they asked him, will you at this time restore the kingdom again to Israel, Acts 1, when he had appeared to them over a period of 40 days, and he told them, it is not for you to know the times and the seasons, my Father himself is the only one who knows that. Even the Son himself does not know that. But you're to go into all the world and to preach the good news, and then eventually it's all going to happen. So as I look at this and all the other prophecies with which I've been so familiar for so many years, and I see the potential of a war which could have been right now raging in the Middle East if intelligent spy satellites parked over the western Iraqi desert had not seen the dust columns and the actual trucks and all their mobile missile launchers moving. 6 armored divisions is a lot of armored divisions, a lot of people, a lot of tanks, a lot of trucks, a lot of their ancillary and support vehicles and so on, and an awful lot of soldiers. And they were moved over there. Now, I knew that and reported that to you a long time ago. That's not because I'm a prophet. It's because I know what the news is saying. That's all that had to do with. I'm just saying that they're poised there for a reason. And the reason was that the tyrant of Baghdad thought that he could not only push George Bush, but he thought maybe now is the time. What he hopes is that not only will all the Palestinians immediately rise up and grab every weapon they possibly can and just begin killing Israelis as much as they can while the bombs and the missiles are raining down, but he also hopes that the other nations will join in. All the other Arab nations, that the coalition will absolutely fragment. Now, why do you think Colin Powell went to Egypt first? Because one of the most very shaky, tenuous peace agreements is between Egypt and Israel. The Egyptians, almost en masse, they are Arabs, not real Egyptians, hate the Israelis. And, of course, the head of Egypt today, Hosni Mubarak. There's Barak, who was out of Israel, and Mubarak, of course, is the president of Egypt, who succeeded Sadat when he was assassinated some years ago, whom I knew personally. But he knows that he could be assassinated any time because of the militants in his country, so he's got to be more careful than George Bush so far as security is concerned, or he could be taken out. And they would love to get Israel just out of the area and every one of them exterminated. Now, I want you to turn to Hosea, the 7th chapter, and verse 8. Why is Tony Blair, as we sit here today, meeting with our president up at Camp David? Why do you suppose the British prime minister came running over here within a day or two of that attack in Iraq? Because British aircraft, Tornadoes, were used, as were American aircraft, and many of Britain's allies and many of our NATO partners were very angry, especially France, Germany, but of course, expectedly, you understand that Russia and China would condemn it and would get very irate and angry that the United States had no business doing that. And there were shrill shrieks of outrage in every Arab capital. I went around with my international acquisition of information on the internet and looked at some of the newspapers, not in Arabic, I can't read Arabic, but you'll have the English editions from capitals from Syria and all over the Middle East to see what they said, including reading one of the English language translations of a Baghdad newspaper and to find out what they were saying. And as one, of course, they accused the Israelis of being terrorists. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. They will turn around and actually accuse. And it is axiomatic that that individual who accuses will almost always be guilty of the exact same thing he accuses someone else of. And so the Arabs are accusing the Israelis of being terrorists and the United States of being terrorists. Hosea 7 and verse 8, Ephraim, and that is Britain, he hath mixed himself among the people. Far more than the United States, who has become a melting pot within its borders, the nation of Britain, the British Empire as it used to be, has mixed itself among all the peoples of the world, from Aborigines in Australia, to the blacks in South Africa, to people in Pakistan and India. There are hundreds of thousands of mixed marriages in all of those countries over the decades and decades when Britain was there. And so when I first went to London in 1954, 5 or 6, I forget which year, and I've been there so many, many, many times since, I noticed that there was far more of a melting pot of races and of languages, and there were whole sections of London where you would see nothing but Asian, East Asian signs and so on. You would see these people on the street wearing their saris and their various strange-looking garb, far more so than you would see down in Los Angeles until the very recent years. Now today, there are whole segments of Los Angeles that are all Korean, etc. And we have done the same thing. But Ephraim has mixed himself among the people. Has Japan? Are there any blonde Japanese? The Japanese even shun marriage with Koreans, and you can't tell them apart. You would make a Korean very angry if you said, are you Japanese? Oh, they'd get very, very angry. If you ask a Japanese, are you Korean? Oh, they'd get very, very angry. They just don't like each other at all. You can't tell them apart. I can, and I'm saying that because I've been there and I know the facial structure and the characteristics of Japanese very, very well, and I can spot the difference between a Korean and a Japanese when I go to Los Angeles to see people that look to be Oriental. But my point is well taken. There are many other nations that have not done that, that have not intermarried, and that have not mixed themselves among other nations. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knoweth it not. Yea, gray hairs are here and there upon him, and he knoweth it not. Way back when the Great Britain, or the British Empire, was at its zenith, my dad and I were saying over and over again that the sun is soon going to set on the British Empire. Were we striving so hard to predict events out of biblical prophecy, which we knew were inevitable with the gradual dismantlement of colonial empires following World War II? It was actually a part of that world public opinion following World War II, when one of the great reasons for the waging of war on the part of the Japanese, which they thought was on behalf of all Asians, was the Greater Southeast Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere, where they thought that the little Orientals were actually superior because they are xenophobic and they believe that they are the master race. They are the superior race. They descend direct from the sun god. Hitler, over in his nation, of course, was trying to breed the great super race of Nordic, as he called them, Aryan, which is a complete mistake. But nevertheless, he was also claiming that they were a super race of Germans. And so the Asians were supposed to be better than the West, and they weren't as corrupt as the West, and so on. We could see that every one of those, when you would see the colors on a map of the reds and the pinks, that at that time, before the idea that red were communists and pinks were communist fellow travelers, the maps of the world and Mercator projections always showed Egypt the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, all of the Middle East, South Africa, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, New Britain, New Caledonia, all the various islands from the Andamans and Nicobars to Hong Kong, to Singapore, the Straits of Malacca, Malaysia, all of it would be colored red or pink. And all around the world, it was true that the sun never set on the British Empire. Now they are all gone. Now there's what's called the little UK, the United Kingdom, of Scotland, England, and Wales. And that's all that is left. Everything else is gone. Now, of course, nominally, because they have their own governments, both Canada and Australia are, in a sense, they revere the crown, but they're really totally separate and independent. They're a part of a commonwealth because they have trading agreements, but they're not really under the crown in that sense. They can go their own way, and they choose to do so most of the time. This is absolutely a prediction of what would happen in the latter part of the 20th century. Strangers have devoured his strength. India is independent. East and West Pakistan split up into Pakistan, and because they are, of course, Islamic, and the people in India are Hindu. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Is there any nation you know of in its history and its demeanor even today that has more pride than the British? They are absolutely very, very proud. Even their Methodist speech, the way they treat other people. They make jokes about you colonials to this day. The United States, Canada, Australia. They look down upon them as a nation of former prisoners because that's the way most of the early Australian settlers got there. The pride of Israel testifies to his face, and they do not return to the eternal their God nor seek him for all this. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without a mind. Now, a silly dove is just frantic, you know, they get frightened and fly in all directions. And the way they used to get dove meat was not because they had shotguns. It was long before the invention of the shotgun. They knew where the watering holes were. And they would spread out nets and lay them on the ground. And they were fine mesh, about the size that a dove's head would fit in. But when he got in there, he couldn't pull himself back out. And they would find, because the doves just loved to come flashing along the little hills and the dales and the valleys, and when there was watering time, I used to hunt doves with a gun, and I know exactly what it's like to be near a watering hole just before sunset when they come to water. And they would come just barreling in there by the hundreds. Up would go the nets, and the doves would fly right into them. And all they had to do was go out there and take the struggling little bodies and, you know, pull the head off or chop it off or whatever, and they have dove meat to eat. And so that is why this biblical analogy is there. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They don't know where their enemies are. They don't know where the danger zones are. They just go around looking for lovers. The entire book of Ecclesiastes that talks about how the lovers are going to abandon Israel. And God saying, because it is an analogy of a marriage covenant, he says, I was an husband unto them. And so his nation, Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh primarily, let my name be named on them. Ephraim and Manasseh are the ones who really wear the title House of Israel more than any of the others, such as Dan and Gad and Asher and Naphtali and Zebulun and Reuben. Ephraim and Manasseh are the House of Israel according to biblical terminology. And they have sought lovers among the nations. We do not depend. Is anybody going to argue this point? I'm sure they're not. Maybe even the writer of the Wall Street Journal won't argue this point. Does the United States government depend upon God for its protection? What a stupid assumption. If someone would stand up on the floor of Congress and say, we need to turn to God and we need to depend upon him for our protection, I suggest we all get on our knees and call out to God and ask him to save the United States. You'd hear the gong, 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 gong. Here'd come careening around the corner, candy wrappers and dust. They'd pull to a stop. Two guys in white jump out with a huge net. They'd grab this guy, kicking and screaming. Everybody'd be applauding as they haul this dumb congressman who just went bonkers, insane, lost his marbles, right in front of everybody. And they'd haul him away in the paddy wagon because they would say, he's insane. To suggest that we turn to God, that we turn to God for our protection. Now, they call to Egypt. Do they? Does the United States, does Ephraim call to Egypt? Why would we do that? Why would we, on the one hand, be the mentor, the supporter, and a lot of times the really strong protector in spite of the fact that they have quite an adequate Air Force and they have quite a nuclear arms program of their own and quite an effective army, but it's a smaller one, Israel. Well, you all know the real story of the Middle East, don't you? It's a little three-letter word. It starts with O. And you know that 80% of the world's oil reserves are beneath those Arabian sands. And they're shared by the people in Kuwait and Abu Dhabi and Bahrain and Oman and Yemen and mostly Saudi Arabia. And, of course, an awful lot of oil in Iraq and Iran and on Karg Island and so on in the Gulf of Arabia. About 80% of the world's reserves. What makes the machinery go around? What do you put in your gas tank? What is it that fuels big business and industry? What is the petrochemical industry? All the synthetics, including the clothing we wear and the glass frames we put on and the pens in our pockets and the pantyhose that our wives wear. It's part of the petrochemical industry. And it has to do with millions upon millions of jobs in the United States and all around the world. And we need that oil. And so we will bend over backwards to placate and to nuzzle up to and to do everything that we possibly can to keep the Arabs all calmed down. And it's a very difficult position for the United States and Britain to be in, because on the one hand, the United States, far more than Britain, is the mentor of Israel. Why? Two major reasons. One is the conscience the world finally achieved when it was exposed in 1945 that Hitler had, in fact, murdered up to 6 million Jews. A lot of that is being revised, revisionist, they call them revanchism, are rewriting history and claiming that Hitler may have roasted a few Jews, but not very many. And maybe it was a few hundred, maybe a very few thousand, but nowhere near 6 million. Well, that's a lie, and they're, of course, doing that. But you all, of course, know about government, and you know about industry, you know about big corporate business, you know about entertainment, you know about Hollywood, you know about the big financiers, you know about the artisans, you know about the great musicians, you know about the influence peddlers in this country. You also know how Hillary got into the Senate, and you know that it had to do with the Jewish vote. And if you think that the Jews, I'm not a person who is anti-Semite, and you read all this literature because people are very alarmed, they're all conspiracy conscious because of the tremendous tentacles of Jews in all of these high level of the central bank and the financiers and the David Rockefeller and the conspiracies that they have, that they believe the Jews are really running the country. And then on the other hand, they believe the Masons are running the country. And then they think other conspirators are running the country. So it just depends on who your favorite conspiracy is. But I think you know that that does have a great deal to do with why the United States feels the way it does about Israel. It's not only because it's the only democracy in the Middle East. It is the only democracy in the Middle East where they have fair elections, where they actually have a parliament, and they have to form a coalition government, which Sharon is having a very difficult time trying to do at the moment, by the way. And another reason why Colin Powell is over there is to try to show support and to see if we can't, again, once again, underline our support for the nation of Israel. When they shall go, they call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. Does the United States and does Britain depend upon Germany for anything? Well, I've told you time and again, when the denazification program began, well, it began in 1945 with the issuance of a questionnaire to all Germans called Fragebogen. And it was a book written by Ernst von Salomon that impugned and ridiculed that book, that document, because that document was supposed to cleanse Nazism out of the soul of all of these hundreds of thousands and millions of surviving Germans who believed in Adolf Hitler. And so the Western Allies turned over the denazification process to the Germans in, get this, ready for this, 1947. Now, you've read the books about the boys from Brazil. You do understand, don't you, that Hitler, in fact, was working not on cloning, but on genetic selective breeding in World War II, and that there were great big, like 6'4" and 7-foot Valkyrie-like women and men that they actually put together in the SS and were producing progeny. So the boys from Brazil, while it was a fanciful idea, the cloning of Adolf Hitler is not really true at all, but there certainly was an attempt by the scientists in Germany to produce a super race at that time. Now, I've recently written an article on cloning. They're now, and it's being done under the aegis of a cult. A cult believes that all of us on this earth are the cloned result of beings from outer space. We are clones from people from outer space. They want to clone a human being. This is a British group, and they're trying to do it in Britain, because they want to produce an embassy staff of clones to get ready to welcome the people from outer space. Tap into the website and read my latest word from it. It's there. And I'll have an article on in the newspaper for all of you that don't have the website, and you'll be able to read it in hard copy, about the movement that these people are making to try to clone a human being now, a human baby. Been tried in Korea time and again on animals, and they've come up with all kinds of hideous deformities, and many of them die. Many of them are just grotesquely malformed, and because of that, most people have shied away from it. But this one outfit, a bunch of weirdos, are going to try to clone a human being to get ready from, you know, Earth to welcome the people from the home country, wherever they think that is. When I see this prophecy that we would go to Assyria, the entire expenditure of billions of dollars of Marshall Plan dollars had only one aim, one goal. That was to rearm, rebuild Germany as a docile ally of the West, as a bulwark against communism. So that instead of wars coming to the United States shores, it would again be launched by the communists in Europe. They would come through the Fulda Gap. I've actually been to some of the forward NATO bases, like the one down there at Bad Tölz, way down in Bavaria. And they knew that the war ought to take place in eastern Germany and Poland rather than somewhere over here, this hemisphere. And for all of those years of the Cold War and NATO, which was nothing more than an expanding military alliance, it was to be a counter bloc to the eastern bloc called the Warsaw Pact, and that was in place for the better part of 45 solid years. And we have always called to Assyria. We have depended upon the Germans. And time and again, short-sighted, stupid, idiotic American government officials have just wailed and wept about these people not pulling their fair share of the load because of the tremendous amount of money we had to expend for the largest contingent of military forces in NATO. And so they always wanted the Germans to have a larger force and to commit more money to it. Don't worry, they will. They will, at our invitation. To me, these prophecies are absolutely alive and have to do with what is happening right at this moment. When they shall go, during the time when we are begging our lovers to come to our aid and to help us, and I imagine right now both Bush and all the people, including Tony Blair, are really wringing their hands about the reaction of the French and the Germans and other people about that airstrike, because, see, they know the truth. Now, you didn't know the truth till about an hour ago. But they knew it way back when it was happening because they got the intelligence reports just like that. And they picked up the red phone and called Israel. So they knew all about it. Way back where? Way back when? When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them, like bringing down silly doves at the waterhole. I will bring them down as the fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. Now, what does that mean? When did Ephraim ever hear? When did Manasseh ever hear that this would happen to them nationally? Did Billy Graham ever tell them? Did Dr. Norman Vincent Peale ever tell them? Did Herbert Armstrong ever tell them? Absolutely. Did Garner Ted Armstrong ever tell them? Absolutely. Have they heard? Absolutely. One summery day in the mid-1960s, I was with my automobile. At that time, I was privileged to be able to drive a car that had a steering wheel on the wrong side. And I was in downtown London. I had just gone past Selfridge's store, and I was right where you had to turn because Bond Street was made into a one-way street. I was right going to turn to the right and go through Marble Arch and on down into downtown London, and I think meet my dad for lunch or something. It was a warm summery day. I had the windows rolled down on both sides. And I heard my voice coming from the right side and the left side. And one was in a convertible, the other was a car with its windows open. And I was preaching away on the World Tomorrow program. And there were two automobiles in downtown London on a summery day that were listening to my program coming over Radio Luxembourg into England, into the British Isles, where we used to saturate London, the big cities of England, with that program for the better part of two decades and a half. So there were an awful lot of people there that heard what we had to say, and prophecies just like this one in Matthew 24 are the prophecies that I was going through at that time. Daniel 11:40-45, as I've said so many times, is one of the most important prophecies. It gives a step-by-step scenario of events we can look for. At that time, at the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him. I don't know who that is yet, and just because Saddam Hussein is pushing at us right now and pushing at Israel right now does not mean that he is the king of the south. Traditionally, the king of the south was a lesser line of Ptolemies and always, therefore, an Egyptian. And maybe that will yet happen. It seems like Saddam is trying to force action to try to give Hosni Mubarak and other people no recourse but to join with him. And, of course, Assad of Syria wouldn't dare deny Saddam's six divisions coming across his border because he would have an uprising in his own nation. How do you deny a brother Arab when the two of you mutually hate Israel together? How do you deny a brother Arab what he wants? And so, of course, they would open their border to those tanks to come rumbling through to attack Israel. And the king of the north. Now, traditionally, that was the Seleucidae, but it was during the time after Alexander the Great's death when the empire was carved up into four quarters, so to speak. And over a period of time, due to wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucidae, and also simply poisonings and other kinds of chicanery and death and assassinations, it eventually emerged that Rome was the final successor. And that's all covered in other chapters in the book of Daniel, of how after Alexander, the kingdom would be divided up into four quarters, as it was. But eventually Rome, which is the final great beast, emerged out of all this chaos and became the predominant world-ruling empire of that time. And the king of the north had then been, in a sense, transplanted. We know that the king of the north is not going to be Syria because of the fact that Syria is, I believe, mentioned right here in connection with some of these, like Libyans, Ethiopians, Cush and Put, and Edom, Moab, and Ammon includes some of those people. Notice then it says that the king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. Well, the architect of blitzkrieg, or whirlwind, lightning-like warfare, of rapid deployment, both by air, the very first person to ever use that in the military was Adolf Hitler when he attacked Norway and the lowlands by paratroopers. First time in all of history that had ever been done, far before the United States ever did it with 101st and 82nd Airborne. With chariots, and you can read tanks, with horsemen, and with many ships, he shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over. That was always an analogy like a river that overflowed its banks in a flood stage. It meant simply going across national borders. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and that has got to mean Palestine, and many countries, plural, shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand. Why? Why is it that apparently he comes into Israel and he also attacks Egypt and some of the other countries, but some of them that are equally Arab, or if they're not Arabic, they are of other stock, such as the Iranians or Persians, and are Islamic, though they are not Arab. Edom is Turkey, is Esau. And that is a nation that has always tried to play both ends against the middle. It's been neutral in World War I and in World War II. And Turkey is Edom. And Moab may well mean Jordan, or I should say Iraq. And the chief of the children of Ammon, and Ammon is the capital of Jordan. And there's a prophecy about Edom and Moab and Ammon that says that they had settled on their lees. And that is a term that means huge big wine vats that just settle on what are called the lees, and they're to remain undisturbed as they age in these huge big oaken vats. And so the prophecies of the Bible said that these peoples of the Middle East would never emigrate where all other peoples have. Basically, many, many other nations have become colonists. None of the Arab states did. They were slave traders, but they did not become great colonial empires. The Portuguese did, the French did, the Spanish did, the Germans had their East African colonies, and the Marshalls and the Gilberts in the South Pacific. The United States, in a sense, did with the Philippines and the Hawaiian Islands and the Panama Canal Zone. And Britain certainly did, and to an extent, Holland did. Look at South Africa, the Boers, who were there first as a fueling station for their ships who went to the Dutch East Indies, as they used to be called. And so these nations were to settle on their lees, and they would be right there to the east of the Jordan River where they had always been, and there they are today. They were there during David's time, and they are there today. biblical history and biblical prophecy are exactly accurate. He shall enter the glorious land, but these shall escape, Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, or Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Is that a punitive raid because Egypt has attacked Israel, or is it because the northern power attacks Israel and Egypt? And I don't think that is correct. I think the northern power goes in there ostensibly to save what Jewish lives there are still alive and to prevent the extermination of the Israelis and to be the great conquering hero with a great false prophet who is going to go in there as the pseudo-Christ who is to sit in a temple of God claiming that he is God and protected by the armies of the beast. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, and Cush and Put, as it should read, shall be his steps. And the Cushites are peoples of both Pakistan and India, as well as Ethiopia and Eritrea. Does this mean that Saudi Arabia will be overrun or occupied? It certainly could, because there again, what would be the main reason why any northern power, especially Europe, which depends far more than 70% upon Gulf oil for its industry and therefore its very livelihood, to go in there, first of all, to prevent a war? Because what does a war do? What do people do when they go to war? Anybody's fertile imagination remember the huge, big blackened skies over Kuwait? Do you remember what Saddam did when he actually set fire to hundreds of oil wells and where billions of gallons of fuel was going up into the air? Some people, when they saw that horror, thought that it would be 30 years before the world ever recovered. Thankfully, they were wrong. But those were horrifying sights. What do they tend to do at war? They blow up pipelines. They attack Karg Island. They blow up docks. They blow up loading facilities. They blow up the chemical and the various oil processing and refining plants. They blow up and sink supertankers and put them where they can block the Straits of Hormuz. They destroy things. They destroy infrastructure. And if they destroy the oil producing and shipping and transshipment infrastructure, including huge pipelines that run up through Syria, so they can unload oil at Syrian ports instead of going all the way around to the Gulf, that means Europe begins to strangle. They don't have oil to run either their domestic or their military machine. So every bit of this makes so much sense. Tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Now Russia and China enter into the picture. Therefore shall he go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many, and that is finally going to lead to the battle of Armageddon. He shall plant the tabernacles, palaces of his palace, and it does mean fortresses in the original, between the seas, meaning between the Dead Sea and the eastern Mediterranean, in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end. You read of that in the 18th chapter of Revelation, and none shall help him. Well, I want to go on and on and on about this, but I thought, well, I got that electrifying report this morning, and then I went to that website and saw the real truth behind what happened just a few days ago, and that none of us had even known how close the world came to the potential of the launching of chemical and biological weapons and a retaliatory strike by Israel using neutron bombs, and not one of our news agencies reported it. I thought I would bring it and tell you about it and put it on this tape for people all around the world to hear it and to know exactly what did go on. Let's close by going to Luke 21:36. We all know what it says. I repeat it so often. It's on our website, and I've concluded many a sermon with it. Luke 21:36, "Watch ye therefore and pray always." And of course, the inference here, the real emphasis is on prayer. I know that there were those who accused me of dwelling far too much on news events. They even said, and they wrote one time, "Beware of someone who comes to you with a Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other." Well, take a look, everybody. Take a look, all of you people out there, and take a look. What have I got in my hand? I got a newspaper, mentions my father and me and the work of God for 50 years, right? And I got a Bible in the other hand. If you don't like that, lump it. I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel about it. I will continue to talk about events that I know are relevant to biblical prophecy because it's going to affect me and my life and my grandchildren just like it's going to affect you and your life and your grandchildren, your children and grandchildren. So I do mention it. But I know that the real strong inference here is, what is emphasized, is to pray always. And that doesn't mean pray and don't take time out to eat or sleep. It means don't ever cease praying. Don't ever omit prayer from your life. Pray every day, sometime. Don't let a day go by without prayer. Don't ever cease prayer from being a part of your very life, just as you eat and you sleep and you drink and you travel and you work. So prayer should be a part of your life. Why? That you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass. That is physical protection. That is escaping with your life. That is not suffering. That's not talking about torture. It's praying that you might be able to escape. I'd like to do that. I'd like to have my family do that, all of my extended family, and all of you and all of your loved ones and your family, not to be taken. As you look in your TV, you see the most horrible sights every single day. This morning I saw blacks in a nation there that were holding little babies and are wading in flood water clear to their armpits and holding the little children up. One of them almost dropped the child as I was watching. You see these horrible things in other nations that are hit with terrible conditions like that, and your heart goes out to them, but you're utterly helpless. There's not one thing you can do. Pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And that's what prophecy is all about. It is not for those who wish to simply sink down into a little local church organization and play church and play church politics and struggle over who gets to serve the beans in a cafeteria line, or whether or not a woman ought to be able to preach. If people want to play church, go and find in the handbook of denominations one that says play church. Maybe there is one named that. It could be, you know, I don't know. There are a lot of weird names, like Fifth Avenue Street, Leapers and Jumpers, Fire Baptized, so on, all kinds of names. But there are people who like that kind of thing. They like church politics. They like to get involved in it. I detest it. I hate it. I don't like it. You've got beloved brethren in a church sometimes that just don't like each other. They're like little kids in a sandlot. I mean, a little kid's in the play school. A kid throws a toy and the other kid picks it up and throws it back. They just don't like each other. But each one of them thinks that they are Christian and Christ-like on their way into the kingdom of God. But they just want to play church politics. They just can't get it out of their system. I would rather be a watchman and engage in the work of God, which is why about 85 to 90% of my time is taken up with the Evangelistic Association, and only about 5 to 15% is taken up with my work for the Intercontinental Church of God. And I think that is as it should be, because we have a wonderful church organization. We have area coordinators. We have ordained ministers. We've got hosts and hostesses of more than 110, whatever it is, groups scattered all over the world, here and there. And it's all doing very well, thank you. But I do not involve myself in that on a day-to-day basis. On an occasion when one of the area coordinators or someone comes to me and says, would you help solve this problem here or there, I try to do my best. But it's a very distasteful thing to me to try to solve problems between people that ought to be loving one another and supporting and helping one another and praying for one another and cooperating with one another. After all, it says, greater love hath no man but that he lay down his life for his friends. And Jesus Christ said, love your enemies. Pray for those that persecute you and despitefully use you. And I find that there are people that don't like each other very much in the same church. That's a problem for them. I hope they can get over their problem before it's too late. Well, I'll quit with that, and lest I preach two sermons instead of one.